Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a Euro deal. Executive orders from the president, earthquake and flood, and police move in on occupiers. In Colorado, President Obama said the economy can't wait on Congress, that he's ready to act.
We can't wait for Congress to do its job. So where they won't act, I will.
Mitt Romney takes a GOP flip-flop charge on an Ohio ballot measure to curb collective bargaining.
Oh, I'm sorry if I created any confusion in that regard. I fully support Governor Kasich's, I think it's called Question 2 in Ohio. Fully support that.
And cries here for a medic in the streets of Oakland, California, as police move in on occupiers and a young Iraq War veteran is seriously injured. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, Chrystia Freeland of Thomson Reuters Digital, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Chrystia Freeland joins us today from New York. She's editor of Thomson Reuters Digital. Chrystia, thanks for being here. Welcome back.
Thank you. Pleasure.
From Washington, we're joined by Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist and editorial board member at the Chicago Tribune. Welcome, Clarence. Great to have you back as well.
Thank you. Glad to hook up with you again.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Chrystia, and Clarence.
Chrystia, hi, everybody. Chrystia, take us right to this Euro deal, if you would. I mean, the Wall Street stock market, the Dow, went crazy over it, but there's some skepticism, and they've still got their hat in hand to China. How big a deal? How big a deal?
I think it's a very big deal. You know, I think that up until the moment of the deal, there was a very real danger that, you know, now we would have Europe falling off a cliff and we would have the European version of the collapse of Lehman with, I think, similarly devastating global consequences. So the fact that that was averted, I think, is a really big deal. Now, the big question people are asking today, having sort of heaved this sigh of relief that, you know, the world hasn't come to an end, the question is this going to be a sustainable solution? And the questions around that are, first of all, you know, all the I's were not dotted and the T's were not crossed in this deal. So we need to see a little bit more detail and we need to see it executed. And there is, I think, a real possibility that it unravels as that detail comes out. Because, you know, the big concern for people is, did Europe put enough money behind this potential deal, you know, to scare away the markets that were betting on failure? And the jury is still out on that. But I think it's still really good news.
Merkel, the German chancellor there, playing a real kind of game of chicken with the bankers, I'm reading here, in the negotiations. I mean, she pushed the banks who had lent money to Greece to take a 50% haircut, write down, loss on their loans there. That's a high wire act, and all reports say she went right down to the wire on it.
Yeah, I think Angela Merkel is emerging as probably the most impressive politician of our time. I think she has handled this incredibly well, especially when you bear in mind that her constituency, her voters, have been very, very skeptical about this. It's much harder to do this deal in 2011 than it was to get TARP through in 2008. And even then, that was hard, right? But now, politicians, I was in Europe recently, and something that European politicians were saying to me is, look, we've seen that all the politicians who bailed out their bankers earn the enmity, the hatred of their voters. So politicians are reluctant. And I think the fact that she forced the bankers to take a tremendous haircut, mm-hmm. you know, they were hoping for a 20% write down.
That was the first deal.
That was the first deal. She pushed them to 50. And they earned that 50% write down, right? They were willing to buy Greek debt and earn huge returns on it, counting on the implicit government safety net. And she's right that German voters and the European voters should not be bailing out the banks, or should be bailing them out as little as possible. So I think, you know, hurrah for Angela.
Though that's the thing that the American government never did. American banks bailed out 100 cents on the dollar. German Chancellor Angela Merkel laid it out very strongly to her Bundestag there, the lower house of parliament. This was on Wednesday, to get a vote on a rescue package, telling them, this is in German, but we'll give a translation here, just how high the stakes were for the continent.
Niemand sollte glauben, dass ein weiteres halbes Jahrhundert Frieden und Wohlstand in Europa selbstverständlich
ist. Merkel saying, no one should think that a further half century of peace and prosperity is assured. It isn't. And that, she says, that's why I say if the euro fails, Europe will fail, and that mustn't happen. Jack Beattie, she's putting the stakes just as high as they could be there.
She is, and she's been criticized for not doing this, for not bringing home to German voters the scope, the stakes here. And in that comment, she did. I mean, one of the great projects of German unification, and before that of the Federal Republic of West Germany, it was precisely this European unification, that this was in some sense a transcendence, a way to answer for the era of nationalism, to cure it. And so she's reminding her people, this is what we wanted. We created this. And this is our responsibility, and something more than just money is involved. I think it was, I quite agree with Christian. This was a remarkable display of negotiating, tough negotiating with the banks, and leadership, really calling her country and reminding them what the stakes are.
But it's not over. Clarence Page, I want to come to you, but here's China's Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs. This is Fu Ying. He's talking to Euronews here this week about China's actions to help Europe with its financial crisis. Now, Europe is now, today, in Beijing, hat in hand, saying, look, we've built the bucket of this bailout. Can you help us fill it? Here's the Chinese Vice Minister.
China has continued its effort, including increasing import from Europe. With almost all the European countries, our import is growing, with more investment coming into Europe, and also with the continued purchasing of euro bonds. We have never reduced the euro bonds in our hands.
Clarence Page, but there's no promise there yet. And here's a whole new picture, Clarence. After all the centuries that we've seen, Europe explicitly going hat in hand to China. I mean, they already own our hat. But here's Europe saying, please, please bail us out, China.
Yeah, China is the World Bank, sort of. What you're seeing here is a negotiation process. The Chinese style of negotiating is to drive everybody to the brink, but very nicely and calmly, the sort of language you just heard. But what's significant here is the difference. You know, we're just talking about how banks, Merkel put pressure on the banks to take a haircut. Unlike in the United States, when our crisis hit in late 2008, the opposite occurred. Wall Street put pressure on the government. If you don't bail us out, we're going to have another depression, worse than the first Great Depression, et cetera. That situation has changed now, where you can see voters have put pressure back. And we're not out of the woods yet. Krista mentioned the markets betting on that have been betting on failure. Credit default swaps, phrase that got Wall Street into trouble that we all remember. That's an issue now, because while the bankers have agreed to take a haircut, the credit default swap markets, you know, is this now, since they were insuring against failure, does this now mean that the insurance policy must be paid up after you have already agreed to a haircut? Do you have to pay the full amount or not? That kind of a question still has to be negotiated, and billions of dollars are involved for various investors.
And do we remake banking to assure against that kind of dynamic getting going again? Still, plenty of skepticism out there. Whatever Wall Street did yesterday, here's Sony Kapoor. This is director of the London-based think tank Redefine, telling NPR that the deal made by European leaders on Thursday is a good start, but he remains skeptical about how it will be implemented.
It's going to take a massive, gargantuan, unprecedented effort of political will that we have so far not seen from our leaders. They have been parochial, they have been petty, they have procrastinated, and they're going to have to get their act together. Otherwise, this is already too late.
So, Chrystia, the sword still hanging over the world economy, over the U.S. economy here, or the odds really shifting?
Well, the sword is still hanging, but I think it's definitely being sheathed somewhat. And I do think, you know, it's there's been a certain tone to the commentary, particularly, I must say, from some of the bankers who were placing bets against Europe coming up with a deal. So, you know, they're also talking their own book a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, there has been a tone of the commentary
today. In other
words,
they had a lot to gain if it didn't work out.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. There's been some tone about, well, you know, this could be just a delay. This may not be the definitive solution. That all is true. But actually, in this kind of a financial crisis, delay sometimes is not a bad thing. You know, even if this kicks the ball or kicks the can down the road for a few months,
ease the tension.
Maybe the world economy looks better by then. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's time for a little bit of a recovery. So I'm not saying that, you know, we can heave a huge sigh of relief, everything is fine, you know, it's not going to fall apart in Europe. But I think that this was a very significant week. And I do think the chances of a Lehman-type scenario in Europe are less today than they were on Wednesday.
Helping inch away from a double-dip recession threat in this country?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I do think, you know, the connection between the European and the U.S. economy is not, you know, absolutely intimate. But I think the reason that people were correctly really, really scared on Wall Street in Washington about this potential crisis in Europe was the U.S. economy is so weak. And that kind of external shock, I think, would have been devastating.
Chrystia Freeland, please stand by. Clarence Page, it's great to have you. Jack Beata, we're going to dive right on in here. President Obama goes executive this week. We've got Occupy issues all over the place. Very tough. A Turkish earthquake. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Barack Obama, the president, out on the hustings this week. First talking about making refinancing more widely available for homeowners underwater. Then in Colorado, in Denver, on Wednesday, Colorado University announcing a plan to consolidate and reduce interest rates on student loans. You'll hear lots of students in the crowd.
Today, I'm here to announce that we're going to speed things up. We're going to make these changes work for students who are in college right now. We're going to put them into effect not 3 years from now, not 2 years from now. We're going to put them into effect next year because our economy needs it right now. And your future could use a boost right now.
Right now. We can't wait, the president says. Clarence Page, and he's got more steps out today, smaller. But what is he doing here? Let's see. Reducing the time it takes for federal research to go into commercial products, creating a centralized online site for companies to get information on federal services. Ooh, we're starting to sound kind of small here, Clarence. Can the president really move this economy?
Well, there's a legal question as whether the president can move some of these things he's moving simply by executive order, since some of them were established by Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another issue. Let's get back to the first point about how we're getting kind of small here. You're right. With the student loans, some of these reforms on average will save a student a grand total of about $3 or $4 a month. However, some aspects will save a little more than that. But the important thing is that this gives him talking points to brag about when people ask, what have you done? At the same time, it also shows that he's not totally hamstrung by Congress. But you're right in the implication that it's hard for him to really act big as long as Republicans blockade his moves.
Jack Beatty, maybe small ball. On the other hand, we remember Bill Clinton when he was in a comparable situation, you know, talking about school uniforms, for heaven's sakes. Of course, he didn't have a near depression on his hands.
That's the key difference, I think. You know, Republicans are charging that this is vote buying of the youth vote. And it's certainly the case that the president needs more support from young people. He got 2/3 of their vote, under 30 vote in 08. Polls now show him barely at 50% among young people. Young people, 16% unemployment for those under 25, and student debt, $1 trillion this year. So he's there's a political issue here. He clearly wants to say, I'm on your side, even if for this small sums of money. But he's got a long way to go to get back that base.
Let's go to our listeners, Stephanie in Boynton Beach, Florida. Stephanie, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I'm behind him 100%, and I'll agree that probably it's not going to have a huge financial impact, but at least he has stopped playing the victim to Congress. He's out there. He's telling the people that I'm behind you, and anything I can do without them, I will. I'm thrilled to see him doing it.
How do you think the politics work here? Do you think Republicans look like, you know, they're dragging their feet, or we're going to hear some of their criticism of the president that he's just off in the wrong direction, Stephanie?
I think that Congress has made it pretty clear that their sole objective is to make sure that he doesn't get reelected, even if the country has to suffer for it.
And the president may be highlighting that with this round of speeches. I mean, it's interesting. They've come back. Stephanie, thanks for your call. Here's a little bit of... Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan, congressman there. This is an interview with Fox News on Wednesday. Here he's accusing President Obama of weakening America with divisive rhetoric.
You know, it's really disappointing, actually. I don't enjoy doing this because he gave us a message of hope 3 years ago of uniting and not dividing. And what we're getting are class warfare. We're getting very polarizing rhetoric that puts class against class, pits people against one another. And I would simply say, sowing social unrest and class resentment does not make America stronger. It makes America weaker.
Chrystia Freeland, there's the argument from Paul Ryan. Of course, he's been on the opposite side of a whole lot of things from the president. And, you know, we've got Occupy Wall Street in the streets making the 99-to-1 argument. But we've also got the Congressional Budget Office coming out this week with this big report saying, look, you know, the top 1% incomes have grown nearly tripled in the last, what is it, 3 decades, while middle class barely budged, and the lower 20 down or flat. I mean, there are facts on the ground here, Chrystia, about who's making what in this country.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's a little bit disingenuous to say, you know, how dare anyone speak about class in America and to act as if saying the words is what creates the reality. The truth is, since about 1976, the pronounced trend in the United States, and this has been largely a global trend, but much more pronounced in the U.S. than anywhere other, interestingly, other than in China, mm-hmm. has been for a huge increase in income inequality. And the biggest gap that has opened up has been, indeed, between the top 1% and the remaining 99%. And it's not even just the top 1%. It's the top 0.1% and everybody else. And the extent to which that very top layer has disproportionately benefited from the economic growth of the 90s, of the past decade, is really extreme. And I think actually, you know, the class warfare is to deny that and to say you're not allowed to talk about this. Why not? I think that that is the most salient political and economic fact in America today. And it's really important for politicians to confront it and to ask, is this the kind of society we want to live in?
Do you see any glimmer of hope in the numbers this week that the U.S. economy may be finding its feet a little bit? We saw consumer spending up, but then, you know, savings back down. 2.5% growth, they're saying now over the summer. Of course, that's not enough to build the economy. The president will strike this pose maybe if we can't wait. But do you see anything that may bring real growth over this next year to the next election, Chrystia?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what we're seeing in the U.S. economy actually is a pretty textbook recovery from a financial crisis. And the bad news about that is the textbook recovery from a financial crisis is very slow, very painful, and very long. It's a 5 to 7 year slog. And I think that that's what we're experiencing. Again, absent any external shock that pushes you into a second recession or any sort of, you know, own goal, which I think extreme budget austerity today would amount to. But the bad news, both, you know, for us as people living in this world and for the politicians facing 2012, is that kind of slow recovery isn't going to feel good. And particularly, it's not going to feel good for the unemployed, where I think that is the single biggest crisis, and not just an economic crisis, but a social crisis, because the number of people who've been unemployed for more than 12 months is huge. And all the studies show that once you pass that threshold, your whole life is altered in a really dreadful way.
Grinding on and on for them. And yes, that hurts. Judy in Oxford, Iowa. Thanks for calling, Judy. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that it's too late. The water has already gone over the dam. The horses have galloped out of the barn.
Which horses? What water, been, Judy? Which what? What are we talking here?
The money has been spent. It's too late. Obama gave everything to the Republicans that they wanted. He pushed all of the money on Wall Street that they could dream of. There's nothing left. What he's doing now is almost irrelevant.
Well, you know, he's going to come back in the campaign season and say, you know what, those deals were cut by the Bush administration, but we got a lot of that money back, even made a profit on some of it. You're not buying, Judy, that he's ahead
of
the curve.
No, I'm not. When Krista talks about how things are progressing and GDP is improving and so on, she's talking about corporations and Wall Street. The rest of us, the 99%, we've got nothing, and there's not going to be anything because the money's already gone.
Yeah, Judy, thanks.
Tom,
Jack, I hear you there.
Yeah, you know, unemployment is a crucial indicator, but political scientists are clear that's not what decides elections. And when they look at the numbers over time, high unemployment elections, there doesn't seem to be as strong a relation as between real disposable income. Is it going up or is it going down? And who wins the election? Well,
who's got that if you're out of a job?
Well, exactly. But of course, real disposable income goes right across the economy, and it's a more generalized condition than unemployment. And when you look at these numbers, in the third quarter, while GDP is going up, just to Judy's point, real disposable income, after-tax income adjusted for inflation, fell by 1.7%. Since 2009, since the recession stopped, it's gone down by nearly 7%. That's the number that the president is facing, that, yes, unemployment is terrible, people are really suffering, but across the board, real incomes are falling.
I want to hear on the GOP side of the slate there how they're looking at this week, what we're hearing. Let's get a call from Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom, for letting me have my say. I'm 999, baby. What about Herman Cain? You know, he describes himself as Haagen-Dazs black walnut. Is that a play to the racist side of the Tea Party? I mean, he's eating Rick Perry's lunch. He's got him over his knee. I mean, he's just blowing him out in the polls. But you notice he's not leading in these primary states, in these caucuses states. And then another thing, this talking point job creators when they're really fat cat job exporters. But Herman Cain, what about the Cain man?
Stephen, let us pick it up, and we'll do it this way. Here's a little kind of video YouTube ad that went viral this week. It's interesting. Clarence, I'll bring this to you, but the Republican presidential hopeful Herman Cain released the ad. It's got his chief of staff, Mark Block, kind of an odd ad, but he's praising the candidate here. You'll hear him. Then, if you see the video, then he's kind of solemnly smoking a cigarette and blowing the smoke in the direction of the camera. I don't know. Here it is.
We've run a campaign like nobody's ever seen. But then, America's never seen a candidate like Herman Cain. We need you to get involved, because together, we can do this. We can take this country back.
And then exhaling his cigarette smoke into the camera. Clarence Page, is this Casablanca? What's going here?
And then that's followed by Herman Cain, a very tight close-up of him with the creepiest grin at the camera that I've ever seen in a political ad.
You say creepy, but he's got a lot of people lining up behind him, you see the polls.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I love my friend John Dickerson over at Slate said Cain is no longer flavor of the week. He's a regular menu item. And that's true. He has carried his uniqueness to a high plateau. Let us remember one fundamental thing. Herman Cain is a master marketer. He is a former head of Godfather Pizza and a former member of the Federal Reserve in Kansas City. But for the last decade or so, he's been a motivational speaker. He's been an author of self-promotional books. He's very good at the sort of thing, does great stand-up, as we have seen. He's very clever. I don't think in his own head he thinks he's got a chance of getting to the White House, but he's doing very well as far are as, you know, right now with the Republican Party in disarray and the right-wing base looking for an alternative to Mitt Romney, it is his turn right now. But I suspect shortly after this current hump, we're going to see the party go right back to Romney when actual votes are cast.
Well, let's look at Romney and Rick Perry. There was an interview with Parade magazine on Sunday, and Rick Perry said he didn't know if President Obama's birth certificate was real, brought that issue up again. Also said in the interview he didn't have a definitive answer to whether Obama was a natural-born citizen, therefore eligible to be president. Asked to explain those comments on Monday by CNBC's John Harwood, Perry said that it was fun to poke at the president about the issue.
It's a good issue to keep alive. Just, you know, Donald's got to have some fun. So, and the issue is.
But it sounds like you really do have some doubt about it.
Well, I haven't seen his grades. My grades ended up on the front page of the newspaper. So let's, you know, if we're going to show stuff, let's show stuff. So, but look, that's all a distraction. I mean, I get it.
All a distraction, but let's talk about it. Donald Trump's got to have some fun, so do I. Jack Beatty, let's look here. Rick Perry, Mitt Romney, Herman Cain, what do you see evolving?
Well, you know, there are two races, I think, on the Republican side. There's the sort of people who are neutral to the Tea Party or not strong Tea Party adherents among Republicans, and they are where they have always been, the 23% behind Mitt Romney. And then there's the race among the others for that Tea Party evangelical base. And there's growing fear, I think. Clarence spoke to it there. You see it expressed on the blogs that there will not be a consolidation in time on that side to a candidate who can beat Romney, and that these bubble candidates, Michelle, Perry, now Herman Cain, they're not getting any traction, and they're not, that Romney will be the last man standing. And you know, the question then for conservatives is, can they bring the enthusiasm? I mean, there's been this enthusiasm gap. Republicans have had it. Democrats have lacked it. Will they have it with him as the nominee? That remains to be seen. But boy, when you look at the polls, he's ahead in, certainly way ahead in New Hampshire, but also marginally ahead in Iowa, in South Carolina, substantially ahead in Florida. He's in good shape.
Christian, do you think it's Romney in the end? All this is just noise in between. Rick Perry can debate or not debate, whatever suits him, but the numbers boil down to Romney. Is that really it, Christian?
Without a doubt. And actually, I think that we all owe, you know, the American people a sort of mea culpa, because I think it's time for the media. You know, the horse races are fun, and certainly, you know, Herman Cain in particular is just so charming. In his unusual approach to the campaign, it's kind of irresistible. But the truth is, you know, barring some act of God, Mitt Romney will be the Republican nominee. And I think it's time to start digging into who he is, what he stands for, and what kind of an alternative he would present to Barack Obama.
Clarence, you buying that, even with all the reservations that are manifestly out there within the ranks of the GOP on Mr. Romney?
Well, you know, it's eventually going to come down to who's the best guy to beat Barack Obama. That's one thing that unifies Republicans these days. And once they get over all the rest of this, Republicans, I mean, just historically, Republicans have tremendous resiliency when it comes to reconsolidating themselves. But Jack is right. Waiting down the road is that enthusiasm issue. John McCain, remember 4 years ago, by the way, we were all talking about how Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani seemed to have a lock on the nominations of their parties. And that's almost exactly 4 years ago we were saying that. McCain, while he eked out the nomination in the Republican primary process, he did not consolidate the right even after he brought Sarah Palin on the ticket and Barack Obama won.
Clarence Page, please stand by. Krista Freeland, Jack Beatty, we are looking at a week in the news, President Obama going executive, the Euro deal, Occupy under pressure. We'll look at that when we come back. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a deadly earthquake kills hundreds in eastern Turkey, but a crowd celebrates movingly here as a baby is pulled alive from the rubble in the town of Erciş.
Allah!
Wow, the joy there in the midst of such a tragedy in Turkey. Catastrophic flooding in Thailand rolls into Bangkok. Two residents here described the rising waters.
In the wrong side, water is at the waist, but inside it's deep more than my chest.
I cannot expect because I've been living for 54 years in Bangkok. I never seen this one before.
Never seen it before. And Bernie Madoff's wife, Ruth, says she and her husband tried suicide. Here she is in a CBS 60 Minutes interview due to air on Sunday.
I said, I just can't go on anymore. We took pills and woke up the next day. It was very impulsive, and I'm glad we woke up.
I just can't go on, but they did. Let's go right to Occupy and what we're seeing there. Jack, there's something changed in the atmosphere this week. The pushback, the police action has hit a whole new level. You heard right at the top of that show that really rough, chaotic scene there in Oakland, California, as the police moved in heavy.
Yes, and not just there. There were similar, although not nearly so brutal situations in Atlanta and elsewhere. The mayor of Oakland did come out the next day and say she supports the movement. She seemed to be regretting that this happened. There was going to be some sort of inquiry into what happened. But, you know, beyond this particular moment, and it could mean more of this, I'm just struck with how far the climate of opinion, to use a phrase of Carl Becker's, the climate of opinion has shifted almost exclusively, or certainly with great help from the Occupy movement. Just consider what the Times poll found on Wednesday. Two-thirds of the public said that wealth should be distributed more evenly. Two-thirds. 7 in 10 Americans think congressional Republicans favor the rich, and two-thirds object to tax cuts for corporations, and a similar number prefer increasing taxes on millionaires. And that is a shift. In, you know, 3 months ago, we were talking about debt, deficit. Now we're talking about incomes, equality, fairness. That is a shift in the climate of opinion, and I think it has been brought about and pushed by this movement.
Clarence, do you think that shift, if it's there in the polls, as Jack points out, does it bleed into the halls of Congress? Power, change. I mean, is Occupy Wall Street, the movement in its many manifestations, making clear a path? Here's a listener online. Ellen says Occupy Wall Street should consider that they need time to coalesce, and getting on the fiscal nerves of straightened municipal budgets, I guess, with police spending, is the wrong way to start. Figure out what kind of presence can last, serve as a central organizing point over the long haul. Do you see that kind of pressure emerging in this, Clarence, or not?
Yes. Yes, the reason why you heard Mr. Ryan speaking earlier about class warfare is because that's the kind of emphasis that has helped those who don't want the public thinking about the wage and earnings and wealth gap. The class warfare came into popular political parlance about 1980, around the time after the Carter era of deregulation, and then Ronald Reagan's era came in. We began to see this tremendous gap in wealth appear that we are continuing to see trending wider and wider. And now what has happened here now, the Tea Party certainly put spending and balancing the budget at the top of the public's mm-hmm. agenda. Occupy Wall Street has shifted our attention now. And we saw at least one major poll this past week, which showed the public showed higher approvals for Occupy Wall Street than they did for the Tea Party. This debate is just starting to get honest, I think.
Let's get a call here from Tariq in Boston. Tariq, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just trying to make a comment on the way Mrs. Clinton points finger at every Muslim nation and says, hey, you need to not be harsh on your protesters. Protesters have a right to speak their mind off. And here comes the United States, and they get one small protest. And how does the United States police respond? I mean, it's the same thing. It's a freedom of speech issue. So if you keep pointing fingers to the rest of the world, you need to look at yourself and say, how did you deal with this protest?
So Tariq, you're looking up maybe primarily this week, though not only by any means, but at Oakland, where we saw that kind of mayhem in the middle of the night there with the police moving in and
yes.
and some serious injuries.
What is the difference between the Syrian forces firing on protesters and the Oakland police firing on
Well, how about live ammunition for one difference? How about all the other hundreds of Occupy protests that haven't been moved out? I mean, I'm not minimizing it, but
so are you telling? So you're telling me that it is okay to keep shooting bullets, rubber bullets, and tear gas on a peaceful protest?
No, I take your point, though. I mean, they can call it beanbags, but those things hurt, and we saw blood coming out of people's heads there. So we take your point, Clarence.
First of all, technically in Oakland, the question of who fired what is still at issue. The police deny they shot even rubber bullets, and they claim somebody else did that because there were some other auxiliary departments involved. But more
auxiliary
of the point,
departments, presumably that still means state security, police,
nearby towns, yeah,
okay,
nearby,
well,
and other agencies.
Yeah,
there. But no, more of the point. You mentioned how many of these demonstrations are going on peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's significant here across the country, including here in Washington, D.C., back in Chicago, where Mayor Emanuel authorized clearing Grant Park at night. They've kind of backed off there, too, because it looked too much like the summer of 68. Across the country, we're seeing local municipalities trying to cooperate for the most part. Oakland has had a decade or more, really going back to the Black Panthers in the 60s, mm-hmm. of problems between police and community. I think it's more of a special case. So if you want to look at us compared to overseas, at least this was not federal action going on there in Oakland, and it's being handled as a local matter that it is.
Nevertheless, I when you look at those images, it's hard for Tariq's point not to come to mind, and one wonders a kind of change in the chemistry this week. Atlanta, Oakland, Nashville. Here's Joshua Shepherd of Veterans for Peace saying that his friend and fellow Iraq War veteran, in this case an Iraq War veteran, Scott Olson, 24, who was seriously injured in the Oakland clashes, has become a rallying cry for the Occupy movement.
Everybody's searching for what the movement is, and he's a very tangible, something you can grab and touch, symbol of this widespread discontent.
Alexandra in Plainfield, Vermont. Alexandra, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
I'm hoping that one of the outcomes of all of this, you talked about shifts, is a shift to really paying attention to the Constitution. The United States Constitution is guaranteed the right to petition, the right to assembly, the right to free speech. Didn't say anything about getting a permit, and yet we have police all over this country going in riot gear and trying to kick people out of public parks. I'm a 65-year-old grandmother, and I am appalled and shocked, and frankly, I'm troubled that the police are committing crimes like that guy in New York who pepper sprayed a woman. That's assault. And so far, he lost 10 days vacation. He hasn't been prosecuted. And yet protesters are being arrested for exercising their constitutional rights. So I'd like to see you guys talk about that a little bit more. Every time it comes up, remind your listeners that these are constitutional rights that were put in place by the original Tea Party people and those that followed. We said, we got to be able to protest the government. Yep. We got to be able to petition. We got to be able to assemble.
Alexander, you make the case well. Freedom of assembly, it is right there in the Constitution. Tea Party, old, new, or Occupy. I mean, Christian, you know, you've seen those police in riot gear. You've seen the crowds in many towns and cities that have kind of camped out. Where does this go? We're heading for winter here. We've now seen this edge of kind of aggressive pushback against the occupiers. What do you see unfolding, Christian?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I'm very much with Alexandra and Tariq. I think, you know, clearly, you know, the Syria comparison is a real, real stretch. But I think the essential point that, you know, both the American Constitution and also, frankly, the kind of conduct which we are expecting in the world today, we are expecting even authoritarian regimes not to beat up on protesters. That was the expectation mm-hmm. in Egypt. That was the expectation in Ukraine with the Orange Revolution, which was also about people camping out in the city's central square. And I think it's absolutely right for people in America to be saying, hang on a minute, that's just what's happening here, and let's hold ourselves to the same standard. In terms of where it goes, I think that Jack made a really important point. I do think already the Occupy movement has fundamentally shifted the debate in America. And I think this could be a watershed moment, you know, in terms of actually a sort of decades-long tone and focus of the political discussion. Really, since Reagan, the focus under Democrats and Republicans, and I think you also saw this in Britain with Margaret Thatcher and sort of Tony Blair taking up that mantle, has been all about liberalization and deregulation, the idea being the way you get economic growth is by pulling the government out, and then you have trickle down and everyone is happy and everybody shares. That has been, I think, actually the global economic ideology. What I think we're seeing right now is people saying, you know, wait a minute, that hasn't actually worked for all of us. I'm not saying, you know, this is a moment where someone comes up with a new communist manifesto, but I think it is a moment when people are saying, you know, we need actually a very different way of thinking about how the economy is working and for whom it is delivering.
Yeah, that is clearly in the air in a big way after Occupy. Much more to come there. But we've got another arrest this week. Maybe this goes to it. Rajat Gupta, former director of Goldman Sachs and Procter & Gamble. So way up high, right at the top of McKinsey, pled not guilty this week to insider trading charges. But he's surrendered himself. He's arrested there. Just to remind us of the kind of stuff that's gone on, here's some sound from a taped phone conversation between Gupta and Raj Rajaratnam, a big hedge fund trader at the Galleon Group. This is 2008. This is all from the investigation that's led to these arrests. Here, Gupta advises Rajaratnam on discussions that had just taken place at a Goldman Sachs board meeting. You want to know how a lot of money allegedly is made in a hurry? Tips like this.
Have you heard anything along that line?
Yeah, this was a big discussion at the board meeting. Mm-hmm. On whether we buy a commercial bank.
Okay, Jack Beatty, you want to know how millions get made in a hurry? A little tip like that, if you know what's you know what it means, and you're in the game.
Well, there it is. You know, there is a game, and if you're on the inside, you win. You know, I polls show Americans don't object to great wealth. They object to great wealth gotten that way, you know, gotten by breaking the law.
Here's
the
a
rules.
Tip, buddy, oh, buddy.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, when you match this up, isn't this just the garden variety sort of insider trading deal that could have happened at any time and has happened repeatedly? This doesn't get to the big boys. This doesn't get to the big banks that blew up the economy. That still seems so far. Prosecuting those people, if they're ever to be prosecuted, seems so far down the road.
I mean, it's interesting.
Maybe they can't be prosecuted, Jack. I think that's exactly the point. But, you know, Gupta, it's a very big deal for Wall Street. He was a hugely respected figure and really, you know, seen as a trusted advisor. He was the head of McKinsey and really, you know, quite beloved. So this is a shock for people.
So was Madoff, right?
You know, Gupta actually played at a different level, actually. So this is a big deal. I don't want to minimize that, but I think
you mean
Jack
$30 billion
makes,
instead of $70 billion. I mean,
it's a different level. But I think Jack makes the essential point that actually this wasn't a systemic thing. If Gupta was indeed guilty of insider trading, you know, that wasn't what brought down the system. And the big question is, you know, was the system brought down because people committed crimes, but the financial architecture was okay? Or did it collapse because the architecture was faulty? And I would suggest to you guys, it's because the architecture was faulty.
We'll see what kind of cleanup we get on that front. It's interesting, Clarence, when inequality gets so big, as the CBO is pointing out this week, you get new kinds of dynamics. I mean, in the reporting at least, Rajat Gupta, who had been at such high levels of corporate America guidance and advising and money-making, no doubt worth millions, but he felt, Clarence, that he wasn't in the billionaire's game, and he just couldn't, the reports say, couldn't deal with that. He needed to climb on up and be, you know, in the billionaire club where it wasn't good enough.
Oh, there's such ample material for Oprah and Barbara Walters and our other great psychoanalysts across the country. Why does somebody like a Bernie Madoff turn into a Ponzi schemer? And he admitted that you know, at least he said from prison that he felt better now because his conscience wasn't bugging him every day like it happened the last 10 years. It's very strange. But, you know, this is not the systemic problem that brought Wall Street down back in 2000. It was more of a casino psychology, widespread, that permeated our whole society and affected our 401ks and the very pillars of global economics. So we're talking about two different things, but the same kind of a strange financial psychology.
In the sense that you can play the system. One more call. Savannah, Georgia. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, you know, this whole thing with hedge funds and the people getting arrested seems familiar. You know, we have a financial crisis created every decade by major corporations and people who are on the inside, so to speak. And maybe this is something that needs to be investigated further.
You glad to see the arrest this week of Rajat Gupta, Michael?
Certainly.
Certainly, and we may be going on down that path. Jack, we don't have much time here, but interesting, we barely get to it. But first, sympathy for Turkey this week. Glad to see when people can climb out of that rubble, and for Bangkok. And then we've got this election in Tunisia, Jack, the first big election since the Arab Spring. And a lot of talk about where the politics go there.
Yes, and an Islamist party won 41% of the vote. They say they're going to go in coalition with secularist parties. We'll have to see. I mean, the challenge there is, can you marry the beliefs, you know, of an open society with political Islam's belief in divinely guided laws?
Maybe they say they're not going to stop bikinis on the beach by foreign tourists, Jack.
Well, that's a start. That's a start. But some people say, let's see what they do with freedom of press. They don't have censorship there. Will they move to that, or will they allow that to keep going?
A lot still to be worked out in the wake of those uprisings. We've got our own sort of ripple of uprising in this country, and from many angles, we're going to watch it all. Grateful to the three of you for being with us today. Chrystia Freeland with Thomson Reuters, digital editor there. It's always wonderful to have you. Thank you, Chrystia.
Thank you for letting me join you.
Clarence Page with the Chicago Tribune. Great to have you back with us today, Clarence. Thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thanks so much, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.